Dina, John, and Sherry in the morning.
103.7
Exactly, does that mean that little thing that I made there? I don't entirely know, honestly, but it was fun to put together. And who is this mysterious Sherry, the other half of this morning show team? That's what I'd really like to know. It's In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. And I could parse it out, I guess. Why, driving into work the other day, I suddenly imagined Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in a morning shock jock jingle. Bombastic, self-appointed man of the people, widely hated. Yet millions do choose to wake up with him every morning. Safe in his perch as long as corporate is willing to take the heat. Now, we're not going to spend much more time on Iran today. The coverage of all that is super thick right now. Any interview or anything that we do would probably be dated in an hour or two. But it certainly is a riveting, depressing, exciting thing going on over there. Despite the fact that, and it's worth keeping in mind, even the most reformist of reform-minded, reformy reformers in the mix is hardly pledging to patch things up and have us over for a housewarming. In Iranian elections, open disdain for the U.S. is kind of like, it's like wearing a flag pin in an American presidential debate. You don't get all thinky about it, you just do it, so you can talk about other stuff. One detail worth mentioning before we move on, the internet in Iran is suddenly extremely slow, we hear. The government has reportedly clamped down on bandwidth, and there are routine disruptions in cell and text messaging service. Worth mentioning, of course, because our many listeners in Iran might have a difficult time getting this episode of the podcast, and sorry to hear that. Let me just say an apology in Farsi. Mote asefam, and maybe we'll see you next week. It's also worth mentioning because that's a nice little segue to our actual first segment in another authoritarian part of the world. Maybe you caught this in the news a few days ago. China wants software pre-installed on all new computers starting next month. That will basically allow the government to block any websites that it wants to. So what would you think, right? This is about political information, trying to block people from getting news from the outside or other subversive material. But the Chinese government says, no, this is not about politics. The problem they've got is with porn, Chinese people and internet porn. So when this news came out, I think most people just presumed that that is completely bogus. But we saw it as a good opportunity to find ourselves a Chinese porn expert and actually see if it might be true. James Farrer is our Chinese sexuality guru for the moment, and he wrote a book called Opening Up, Youth Sex Culture and Market Reform in Shanghai. So thanks very much for joining us.
Good evening, or good morning, as the case may be.
Well, it's one of those for each of us, isn't it? At the moment, he's a professor at Sophia University in Tokyo, Japan. So yeah, thanks for battling the time difference to talk with us. Do you think the Chinese government really cares so much about blocking internet porn?
Well, I think they do. And it's not to say that there may not be other motives, but porn is something that the Chinese have been worried about and thinking about as a kind of spiritual pollution for quite a long time. One issue is that I think the Chinese look at porn as something that comes in from outside and therefore is particularly nefarious.
Is this the first big attempt by the Chinese government to take a stand on this issue?
They tried it in years past. The state in the 1980s and 90s, you know, was censoring all sorts of magazines and print media to make sure there wasn't any porn. And in some ways, China has always, or at least in the last 40 years, connected sexual immorality to political impurity. And that certainly was in the case of the Cultural Revolution, where, you know, people who were politically bad were often accused of sexual immorality. So this tendency to see porn as a kind of social danger, I think, has been around. And it's always been something that the state could trot out and say, "This, we're trying to control foreign influences and stop foreign spiritual pollution."
Is it an economic worry in China, or is there sort of this kind of like American-style, like puritanical streak that is behind it?
Quite simply, it really is a puritanical streak. I think behind it is a fear that people are losing control of youth. And that youths are somehow going to become rotten and, you know, obsessed with this kind of self-indulgent material instead of being the good students and good citizens that they're supposed to be. You know, in China, even now, in high schools, young people are prohibited from dating.
High school students are prohibited from dating?
Right.
How are they, yeah, how is that done?
If you're in school and you're, like, holding hands with your classmate or something, you know, you'll be told by the teacher, you can't do that. This is prohibited, you know. What is it, moralism or economics? It's both, because for parents, you know, it's all about just getting this kid, this sort of educational pressure, getting them in the university, getting them to be an economic success. And that, I think, means that sex and dating and all these things are considered a huge waste of time by parents.
If the Chinese government is blocking people's pornography, which is what they want to do starting in July, is anybody, you think, going to protest that?
Online, you're going to get a lot of protest and derision of this decision, but I don't know if you're going to have, you're not going to have anybody out on the street holding up signs saying, you know, I want my porn. I
think it, we wouldn't even have that here, would we?
No, I don't think we would.
Much less really in
would.
China. What's Chinese porn like?
Well, I think you can, you know, pornography is a gigantic industry, and you can find just about anything, and you can find all the weird and quirky stuff. But I would say that Chinese are increasingly interested in homegrown porn, you know, amateur porn, that people taking shots of themselves or their girlfriends. And then there's also a big interest in Japanese porn.
Hmm.
So there, I think there, to some extent, is kind of ethnic, racial element that people are interested in, you know, East Asian pornography.
What, if anything, would worry you if this is successful? I mean, is there a danger to a internet porn-free China?
Porn is a funny thing. It's something that almost nobody ever defends. And so I'll defend it a little bit. I think that if you look at China, you know, 25, 30 years ago, where there was absolutely no pornography and very little erotic art or very little erotic film, I think Chinese people had very little information about sex. And nowadays, you know, they do. Realistically, the downside might be more underground commerce, more involvement of criminality. This is often what you get. Anytime you ban something, you're actually just strengthening criminality, and that's certainly what you have in the prostitution business. I can't see it having a positive effect on Chinese society.
Well, Professor Ferrer, thanks very much for your time.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
That's Professor James Ferrer. He teaches at the Institute of Comparative Cultures at Sophia University in Tokyo. His book, if you're interested in learning more about this stuff, and who doesn't want to learn more about Chinese sex and pornography, is Opening Up, Youth Sex Culture and Market Reform in Shanghai. Quick update to this story before we move on. Unnamed Chinese officials now say that while this censoring software will be required to be shipped with all new computers sold in China as of July 1, installation of the software will technically be optional. And the name of the software, I also want to mention this just because it's funny, is been being translated as Green Dam Youth Escort. Now, the Green Dam part of it is a little complicated, I guess, but Youth Escort, maybe they mean something like, you know, chaperoning. In Chinese, it conveys chaperoning the youth, the vulnerable youth, through the dangerous passageways of the internet. But in translation, youth escort is what they get, and probably not exactly what they had in mind. Let's take just a moment to acknowledge our 1,000th In The Loop Facebook fan, Greg Flanagan. Greg pushed us to 1,000 on Friday night, I believe, and at the moment we're sitting at 1,071, so we breezed right on past it. You know, we asked a question on our Facebook page the other day, which you can get to, by the way, at loopfacebook.net, because we're in the process of brainstorming kind of a little slogan. We need it just kind of for, well, for internal use and external use, you know, a little pithy way to capture what the show's all about and who we are. And so I asked on Facebook for some suggestions, and my goodness, people responded with great enthusiasm, or at least some people did, and here are some of our favorites before we move on. Aaron, perhaps, and I think she's from Wichita, bringing the news around and back again, kind of embracing the whole loopy kind of a thing. James, and it's not clear at all where James is from, having a little fun with our digital transition here, I guess. In the Loop, public radio without the radio. Thank you, James. Similarly, our buddy Mark in Paris, In the Loop, let he who is without a broadcast slot cast the first pod. Give you something to think about. Dano, good old Dano. I don't think we've ever met Dano, but my goodness, he had a lot of fun with the slogan concept and gave us maybe a couple dozen to choose from. Dano in Minneapolis, these are some of the funny ones that we liked from Dano. Every time someone unsubscribes on iTunes, Sandin loses a finger. Sandin enjoys thinking about that particular one. And another one from Dano. In the Loop, if podcasts don't work out, we're going to come to your house and do this. Dano, that is probably closer to the truth than even you knew when you wrote that. Finally, here's one from our friend Sarah in Minneapolis. In the loop, because content is king. That's a nice one to end on. And we're actually going to hear from Sarah again in just a minute, because we threw a question out this past week to our Facebook folks and to our email list, our network, as we call it, which you can sign up for at intheloopshow.net. If you're not in that group already, we want you, asking how this cruddy economy is going to mess with your summer. Because last summer, remember, the economy was kind of falling apart, but we didn't really know it yet, certainly didn't really appreciate the depth of the problem, and so everybody went blissfully about their summer plans. Well, this summer, not only do we know, but many of us are directly affected in one way or another by what's going on in the economy. So we thought we'd just ask for some reactions to that. And we got a number of good ones. And in fact, we'll start with Sarah. Sarah Martin is her full name from Minneapolis. And let me call it up on my computer here. Sarah said that for her, what started out as a spring full of financial panic and woe is now turning into actually what could be the best summer of her life.
So, you know, the economy had just really tanked. And I'm going, oh, my God, oh, my God. So I started, you know, putting away a huge chunk of my paycheck every month, like in the hundreds of dollars. And then I started going, like, what am I doing? I didn't see that money doing me any good sitting in the savings account. So I decided to go to Burning Man for the first time. A huge art festival out in the middle of northwestern Nevada in the desert. Rather than trying to protect myself from what could possibly happen because the economy has gotten so bad, I decided to spend it on a worthwhile life experience because, I mean, we're only here once.
Now, I don't know if they discussed this. It's not clear if they did, but we also heard independently from Sarah's boyfriend, Gabe. And by the way, this is the only relationship that I think we're aware of actually spawned by In the Loop. If there are others, we want to hear about them. Let us know. But we're very proud of this, Gabe and Sarah. Anyway, Gabe writes, I'm still unemployed. He's been unemployed for a while. And if I'm going to go to Burning Man with my girlfriend, I'm probably going to have to fake out my parents into buying part of my ticket. Well, Gabe, good luck. Because as you just heard, Sarah's kind of looking forward to this. So hope you can make it happen. We heard from a number of people who had sort of job employment-related concerns about this summer. One of those is Will Jaffray. He's a student at the University of Minnesota. And for Will, this lousy economy is going to seriously cramp his style.
The job market is so rough, especially for summer jobs, I think, that all I could find was a job that will have me working Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights making pizzas, which naturally is not the times a college student wants to be working during the summer. If I had started my job hunt aggressively in February or something, I might have a more attractive option right now.
Got a few others here. We heard from Brian Riley, who wants to remind us that while this summer is going to be kind of rough for many people, himself included, there are lots of places that are really bad all the time, like Cameroon in West Africa, where he went recently. And we heard from, let's see, James Johnson in Memphis, Tennessee, says he's had to cancel plans to attend the family reunion, and the family's decided to just stay home by the pool, except for the fact that, for financial reasons, they have already shut down the pool due to the price of chemicals. But they have had a bumper crop of tadpoles this year, which is cheap excitement in this down economy. Let's hear from another person here, Jamie Kleeman, who is here in the Twin Cities as well, who is a freelance writer, works sales at a high-end retail store, and also takes on temp jobs. But even with all this, she is not finding enough work this summer.
Temping is really, there's nothing. I probably won't be going on vacation. I'm afraid to go out of town at all because I don't want to miss any hours at the store.
But there is a silver lining. Jamie says she's using some of her extra downtime to better herself.
It's given me an opportunity to cultivate my sense of humor, I would say, and then just focus on artistic projects. You know, I started writing a play that I've been meaning to write for 6 months, and I'm taking an acting class, and I'm reading a bunch of plays. So that's a good side of it, just being able to get back in touch with myself and my creativity and work on that.
Now, finally, we did hear from one person in particular who said, you know what, I'm going to have a great summer, and it's because of the economy. And that was Meg Hanrahan. Meg, where are you again?
I live in Burke, Virginia.
Okay. And what is your job that makes this such a great summer for you?
Well, actually, I'm a federal bank regulator.
So you work for, like, the FDIC?
That's correct.
Okay, so like the big bank regulator.
Yeah, one of them. And I work trying to analyze the banks and see what may be coming down the pike. And we're just really, really busy. So I feel very secure in my job, and I feel that my husband and I can kind of do the things that we may have put on hold because I know that I'm at no risk of losing my job.
What are you going to do with yourselves this summer since you're feeling so good?
We're going to add on to our house, and we're going to build a screened porch. Our equity line is available, so we're going to use our equity line and build a screened porch onto our house.
Not the kind of thing you want to leap into if you're not so sure worth it. Where are you going to be a year from now? What, if I might ask, does your husband do? Is he feeling equally happy with things right now?
That's kind of interesting because we feel confident in my job and the security of my job. As of Friday, he became a stay-at-home dad.
Wow.
So today was his first day that he did not have to go to work.
Now that's a real vote of financial confidence.
Yeah, we just decided, you know what? We can afford it and things are going well. I know I'm going to be very busy and be well-employed for the next 2 years, so why not take this opportunity that we have?
Now, I'm looking at the note that you sent us in response to this question, and you said, rotten economy, not for me, exclamation point. You don't seem very modest about your joy, your comfort.
Well,
right now.
You know what? When I graduated from college, I took a job with the government, and I have to admit, a lot of people poo-pooed me, kind of like, oh, you're going to work for the government? Like, that was kind of like the bottom, and I started at like $18,000. Way less than all my other peers. And believe it or not, I'm now getting emails from my peers, my alumni, saying, is the FDIC hiring? What do they need? This is my experience. So people are now coming to me looking for a job.
So not really, you know, like a told you so kind of a moment, but just a, I don't know, like a satisfaction that after all this time, you made a smart choice.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Meg, it's been fun to talk with you. Thanks for letting me read you at home.
Thank you. No problem.
All right. That's Meg Hanrahan, listens to In the Loop in Burke, Virginia. Speaking of interesting summers people have coming up, I've been thinking a lot about these Uyghur guys from Guantanamo Bay. You may be familiar with the story. You probably are, but here are the very basics of it, just in case. Shortly after 9/11 and the war in Afghanistan, the United States, somewhere in Central Asia, picked up about 22 of these Uyghur guys, and somehow they wound up in Guantanamo Bay. Now, Uyghur is an ethnic group that lives in Central Asia, and there are many of them in Western China. And so after all this time, 7-8 years go by, we finally determined some while ago, I guess, but we've been still hanging on to them, that they're not actually dangerous. They're not enemy combatants, and so they have to go somewhere. Well, they can't go to China, because there's this whole Uyghur independence movement, and sending them to China would be about the worst place that we could send them, especially after what they've been through. And they can't come to the United States, because I don't exactly get that part. Congress said they can't come to the United States. So these guys have been in limbo. A couple of tropical locales stepped up, for whatever reasons, and said, we will take some, maybe all, of your Uyghurs. As it turns out, in the last couple of days, the first of these guys, four men, have landed on the shores of Bermuda in the middle of the Atlantic. And the other place is Palau, which is a tiny island in the middle of the Pacific. And you have to imagine this will not be the easiest transition for a group of Uyghur freedom fighters from Central Asia who have just spent the better part of a decade in solitary confinement. So I think what's needed is, I don't know, maybe a little bit of a PR campaign here, right? Both to help the islands kind of capitalize on the moment and their generosity in this instance, and also to help these Uyghur fellas have a soft landing in their new homes. So here you go. This is our contribution to the Uyghur resettlement effort. I hope they can use it.
Well, hello there. The beautiful islands of Bermuda and Palau would like to welcome you gentlemen to our sun-kissed shores. Here you will find many friendly people, beautiful beaches, and so many varieties of fruit. The peoples of Bermuda and Palau have written this welcome message to say, hello, Uyghur friends. We know our tiny islands will be wonderful places in which to spend the rest of your lives. Well, you spent 8 years in Guantanamo Bay. Anybody would be bitter, but you're free today. So let go your worries in the island way. Get used to the place because you're here to stay. Well, they locked you up, threw away the key. No easy way to let you go gracefully. Couldn't turn you loose in the US, you see. Because logically you might go after Dick Cheney. Well, better than to send you to this happy place where we can help you turn the page. People often come here to escape and erase. Yes, we're tiny, but we're bigger than a chain link cage. Think about it. Now might think they'd have you in the USA. After all, it's them that threw your lives away. But something tells me even if you had a voice, Bermuda and Palau would be your second choice. They tell us you're no danger, you won't make a fuss. Barack Obama's word is good enough for us. We'll do our very best to make you feel at home. But we don't have any mountains and we don't speak Uyghur. And you might not like the food, the days are hot and long. Bikinis and Islam don't always get along. We know that you've got families and Uyghur wives, but you're coming to the islands to reboot your lives. Yes, sometimes you gotta play the cards you're dealt. Hey, it's way better than China or the Bible Belt. So relax, grab some shades of fruity drink on ice. You've earned a lifetime trip to paradise. Yes, relax, my friends. You've earned a lifetime trip to paradise.
All right, and with gentle apologies for the non-existent hybrid Bermuda Palauian accent that I invented there. We're calling that one Island Uyghur Welcome Song. And, you know, I hope they can use it. Like with the song we recorded for the previous episode of the podcast, that North Korea thing, I videoed the process of recording that piece of music as well. And we should have that put together pretty quick here. And I hope up on the site, both loopfacebook.net and intheloopshow.net. So check that out. Real live miniature steel drums and all. I dug them out of my attic. I'd never used them for anything, but I've used them now. This is In the Loop, of course. I'm Jeff Horwich, and let's keep her moving. Every now and then, we put out a periodic call to turn up new people who can come on In the Loop and fill us in on their news niche, we call it. Some area of human life that they follow more closely, you might say, than your average podcast host or podcast listener, for that matter. One of those pings not too long ago turned up Steve Rode from Wake Forest, North Carolina. Steve has taken his personal experience and his passion for one particular topic and turned it into what you might call kind of a public service blog at getoutofdebt.org. Steve, thanks very much for talking with me today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And you've been at this in one form or another online, giving advice about this kind of stuff for, what, like 15 years now, huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, I lived through personal financial problems myself back in 1990. And, you know, after going through that experience, I thought there had to be a better way to help people.
And if you wouldn't mind giving me a few of the juicy details, what happened to you in 1990 that got you so into this topic?
I'm probably the only man in the country that has his life dedication of helping people to get out of debt based upon another man's wife, a shotgun, and a bottle of whiskey. That's a
for
long
real?
Story. Yeah, for real.
I don't
yeah.
care if it's a long story. What can you tell me if that you're not prohibited by law from discussing?
Yeah, I think the limitation has expired by now. No, what happened was I started a real estate business back in the late 1980s, buying large tracts of land and selling them. Mm-hmm. I was putting charges on my credit card. The sales would go through. I'd pay off the debt. We had a big farm that was supposed to sell, and that farm was going to clear off my 25 grand of debt that I had carried in promoting and selling that farm. And the buyers called up one last time and said, we'd like to see the farm this weekend. We know the closing at the bank's on Monday, but we'd just like to go by and look. And I had this agent who was working for me, and he said, Steve, you know what? I'm heading out there. You don't need to go. I'll take care of it for you. Well, I didn't know that this agent who worked for me had a drinking problem. And he went out to the property the day before, bought a bottle of whiskey, drank the whole thing, passed out in his truck. When the buyer showed up the next morning and knocked on his door, he jumped up, grabbed a shotgun, pointed at him, and then when he became more coherent, started making sexual advances towards the guy's wife.
Long story short,
the deal fell through.
Not surprising.
And then that started a chain reaction. And then once you start to fall behind, it's the domino effect. So I ended up turning into bankruptcy.
Let's get into some of the stuff that you've been thinking about and writing about lately. We especially wanted to talk with you about one item that was on your blog the other day. Financial education for high school students sounds like a good thing, but at least according to some new research, not only does it not work, it might actually make them worse at managing their money.
It's crazy, isn't it? It seems like the opposite result. But it is true that high school students who go through financial education classes in high school actually score worse than the high school students that don't.
Score worse on what?
On financial exams.
What could be going on there?
It must be mildew or mold in the schools or something. Nobody knows the answer. Huh. But for the last, almost 15 or 20 years, education systems around the country have been pouring money into financial education as if it somehow inoculates students and prevents them from getting into trouble. And it's just not true.
What kind of stuff are they teaching to high school students in these classes? What do they want them to come away with?
Well, it's the basic stuff.
Don't get drunk in your truck when you're heading out to a rural area to buy a farm and a deal. They cover that one. Okay, sorry.
It's basic things. You know, don't spend more than you make. How to balance a checkbook. This is what a credit card is. Now, college students do better on these financial tests. And it might be because it's more relevant to them. They now have student loans, so they're paying, attention to these things.
Let me ask you about something else that you've been writing about lately. Attorneys general in some number of states are in the midst right now of a big push to take on debt settlement companies. What is considered a debt settlement company? That sounds like something that actually might be useful for many people who need to, settle their debts.
Well, it does. A debt settlement company is somebody who will negotiate with your creditors and allow you to repay less than you owe as full settlement of your debt. I've had worked with people in the past who have settled their debts. They've owed $20,000 and had $12,000 cash on hand and went to the creditor, and the creditor agreed to take the 12 as full payment for the 20, and they avoided bankruptcy that way.
Sort of negotiate for you with your creditors to help you maybe get a better deal.
They will, and what these debt settlement companies that are being cracked down on do is they will say to the consumer, we will settle your debts for 30 to 50% of what you owe, and you need to make a payment of X $100 to us each month. We'll save up the money, and then when we get enough money, we'll contact your creditor and we'll settle your debt. But what they don't tell you, and here's where they're getting into trouble, the first $4,000 or $5,000 they accumulate is going to go towards their fees before they ever contact your creditors. So in the meantime, consumers are getting sued by their creditors, thinking that the situation's under control, they're in collections, their credit report is trashed, and these settlement companies are not providing any sort of customer support or service and leaving lots of people stranded paying $4,000 or $5,000 worth of fees for nothing.
So the state attorneys general are trying to, wipe this category of company off the map, or do they just want to, get them to behave better?
They're trying to legislate and regulate them off the map, and debt settlement companies are being resistant to regulation. They want to perpetuate what they feel is a good thing that they've got right now.
So if companies like this are ripping you off, what is a consumer supposed to avail themselves of to help improve their situation if they're in debt to that level?
Money problems are best solved by lifestyle changes, increasing income or reducing expenses. It's very basic stuff. The tough part is letting go of a house or a car, for example, something that we hold to the outside world as our status in life, our position, and to show others how successful we are. People hold on to these things all the way to the bottom.
Well, they want everything. They want to sort of
and we want it
nothing.
Now.
So that's a crucial piece of advice that you give to people. You have to choose what's not going to work out for you here.
Right. There are solutions. For example, if you're thinking about losing the house and losing the car, and you've got a bunch of unsecured credit debt, maybe we need to think about bankruptcy. A lot of people go, I don't want to go bankrupt because it's shameful. And the people that do go bankrupt, they really internalize it. But if it's the only legal solution that's available to consumers today, we can't take it off the table.
Well, Steve, thanks very much for taking some time to talk with us and bring us into your world of debt-related news.
You're very welcome.
That is Steve Rode. He will answer your financial questions at getoutofdebt.org. If, like Steve, you've got a news niche that you follow really closely, let us know about it. You can find us at intheloopshow.net. And as always, whenever we have anybody on who's talking about financial matters and offering something that sounds sort of like advice of some sort, we have to offer a disclaimer. And here it is in Steve's own words.
I am not an attorney, and you need to speak to a local attorney for legal advice in your state. And for tax advice, you need to speak to a tax advisor. What I do provide is advice from the heart because I care.
Aw, thank you, Steve. Now, a quick follow-up to something we had last time on the podcast. You might recall I talked with a listener out in Oregon. Her name is Alina Roberts, who is blind, and she writes a blog and follows all kinds of news that's of interest to blind people and to non-blind people, but about technology and science especially that relates to blindness. And it was a cool interview. We took a question from one of our other listeners who wanted to know, do you dream, and when you dream, do you see anything? And Alina very gamely handled that question and said, well, she went blind at around 15, so she does still carry a lot of these images around in her head, and when she dreams, she sees them. And of course, the answer to that question is going to vary depending on whom you ask. And someone in the building, a listener of ours here in the building, stopped me the other day and said, what I'd really want to know, and maybe what that question asker really wanted to know, is if you've been blind since birth, what do you see when you dream? And so Alina helped hook us up with Darcy Bernard and Holly Anderson, who host a podcast together called The Darcy and Holly Show. Darcy's in Ontario, Canada, and Holly is in Gainesboro, Tennessee. Both of them are blind from birth, and they were willing to take a stab at answering our question. So let's hear it.
Hello, I'm Darcy Bernard.
I'm Holly Anderson. I dream the same way that I perceive, I guess, the world. Like, I have light perception, so I can see light. And so, you know, I'll dream, but I don't see because I don't have any concept of that.
Right. And I have never had light perception of any kind. So when I dream, I don't have any light at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no way for either of us to perceive things like colors or images because we've never seen those things.
Right. Like if I dream about, you know, it's daytime, then I'll see light like the sun or whatever, but I won't. Whereas, I don't see images and stuff.
If it was daytime for me, I would probably hear things that I would associate with daytime.
Right.
Or I would be aware it was daytime in some respect. Just like I'm sure if you were to ask a person who's never heard, they probably don't have sound in their dreams.
Because your dreams are just based on your experiences in the world, I think.
Right. For the same reason that a totally blind person who's never had vision doesn't see black. Someone who's had vision and has lost it will see black, but it's someone who's mm-hmm. never had it doesn't have any concept of anything.
Right.
And I think that answers the question.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. Darcy Bernard and Holly Anderson. You can check out their podcast, if you like it, darcyandholly.com. Now, one more quick hearkening back to our previous episode. As you recall, we had some fun with North Korea-related music. And just after that podcast was put to bed, as we say, we got a submission from two listeners who put their heads and their talents together to do kind of a Kim Jong-il perspective take on Blues Traveler's Hook. And so I'll play just a bit of that for you now. Jessica Sondheim wrote the lyrics to this thing, and Lacey Joy Olson is the one doing the singing. So here is just a taste for you.
Making trouble at my border so that your fear of me will grow, because the news brings you back. So
well done, and as many of you probably know, there are a lot of lyrics in that song, so there's much more to it, to the parody version from Jessica and Lacey Joy. So if you want to check that out, you can look for it on our Facebook page or go to intheloopshow.net, and we have posted it there for you to give it a listen. So thank you for showing folks how it's done. We always welcome your creative impulses whenever they strike. For our final act, a little bit of an experiment, and also something coming up that if you're one of those people who misses the In the Loop Story Slams, I think you'll probably enjoy the way we end the show today. As a host of a radio show turned podcast and a semi-pseudo half-baked public figure, I get a fair number of Facebook friend requests, personal Facebook friend requests from people whom I don't actually know. And I embrace that. Not everybody does, but I do. What the heck? And usually that just is what it is. Well, I got one the other day that made me think, you know what might be fun and interesting is to actually meet some of these people. And along the way, maybe also help introduce listeners of the podcast to other listeners out there who may have something to share and just be kind of interesting folks. So here we go. The first in a series of what you might call Jeff actually meets his Facebook friends. And here's the one that gave me the idea. Came from a fellow named Terrence Greep. Now, he's a comic book writer, among other things. He's written for Batman and the Green Lantern, but especially Scooby-Doo, which is very interesting in itself. But there's something else that I should tell you to set up our conversation here. Terrence was named by City Pages, our local alt-weekly here in the Twin Cities, the best professional wrestler in the Twin Cities for 2009, which is no small deal, and he holds a number of belts. He wrestles under the name Tommy Spider Baby Saturday. And before I play some of the conversation I had with him, here's just a little internet clip of one of his recent matches.
Midwestern champion, Tommy Spider Baby Saturday.
No chance. Come on, Spider.
Tell me about your wrestler persona. The name Spider Baby, where does it come from? And are you, what do they say, like a hero or a heel? I don't know my terminology that well. I've been doing my research. Right, tell me about Spider Baby.
The name Spider Baby just sort of came to me. It's a bolt out of the blue. The only actual inspiration I've ever had after all these years of writing and wrestling. He's kind of the rock star, or at least he envisions himself as such. But he's definitely got a goth flavor to him. And he's funny. And so the fans just would not stop cheering for him because they knew when he came out, they were going to get a show. Started off as a villain, a heel, as you correctly say. Turned into a good guy, maintained a tag team, a championship tag team for some time, and just turned on my partner, and now I'm a bad guy again. A heel, as you say.
What was your reception like in the wrestling community when it was obvious, and you never hid it, I guess, that you were gay?
Well, yeah, it's funny. I didn't know how to handle that at first. People figured it out very quickly because I had all sorts of things on the internet for Out Magazine, for Advocate. I mean, and I wasn't exactly closeted, but I didn't.
Things you'd written for those magazines.
Exactly. So, yes. It was a little bit of gossip for about 2 weeks, I think, and then they got over it very quickly. When you come out as a gay wrestler, people insist you sort of embrace that gay archetype. So I thought, okay, I'll show you gay. And then I went into the headdresses and the sunglasses and the feather boas, not unlike Ventura. The feather boas have kind of fallen by the wayside because I hold all these championship belts and they dangle into the shiny belt and it kind of defeats the purpose of wearing a title. You know, you want to do everything to promote that title, make it seem important. And it is important, but not if it's blocked by feathers. But everything else is still there. And so...
So what does that mean? Are you to say that you're gay when you're wrestling, how does that appear in your persona other than the boas?
That's a good question. It's if you've ever heard of Gorgeous George, I mean, he was flamboyantly but completely tacitly gay. You know, everyone knew in terms of character. So I just kind of modeled myself after that archetype. I wear real thick eyeliner, bright red lipstick. I usually will wear this rainbow bandana around my left thigh, just underneath my knee pad, and it just sort of conveys, you know, you know something about this person, the character matches up, and now watch me beat this guy up. I mean, it has nothing really to do, there's nothing more gay than that, but that says a lot.
How is it positive, you being out there as a gay wrestler, you know, in terms of what it conveys about the LGBT community? What are you contributing to the movement by being out there and wrestling?
I hope it just... beats up stereotypes just generally. You know, you're not going to bash this gay guy. He's going to fight back. I'm also kind of a submissions specialist, so getting straight guys to tap out is something that the gay fans just love, I've noticed. And it wasn't by design on my part. It's just the moves that I find most interesting, and so I kind of integrated those. But more than anything, it's what we're doing. We're just talking about these issues and hopefully changing people's minds.
Now, you can kind of hear the hubbub in the background there. I went to meet Terrence the other night at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis because he was doing a reading there as part of a Queer Voices event. And so I'm gonna play that reading for you now. It was pretty great. It was just like the kind of thing we loved to get, you know, at our story slams. Two quick things I'll mention. This is a condensed version of something that he wrote originally for Lavender magazine. And it does have one, not vulgar, but somewhat off-color reference that comes about two-thirds of the way through. So if you're listening to this podcast with your young children, you will want to be aware of that and protect their virgin ears. In any case, here is Terrence Greep reading, I should say, as Tommy Spider Baby Saturday. Enjoy.
After I earned my first title, the Northern Lights Wrestling Midwest Heavyweight Championship, on August 19th, 2007, I named the belt Ramon Wolzaldo Furter Clement. Then, still dripping with the sweet sweat of salty victory, I bounded upon the Lisa Marie 2 and took the red eye to Vancouver, where a Unitarian minister with an antiquated haircut and an absolutely fetching underbite performed an emergency marriage ceremony. Thus, the championship is no mere fashion accessory to the spider baby. Ramon is my life partner. Bringing Ramon into my life was the culmination of a journey, a grand conniving, really. I began my wrestling career as a heel, or bad guy, which offended the more politically correct members of our dysfunctional GLBT tribe, who were offended anyway. I know that because they're always offended by something. They claimed I was trading on my gender identity within the not altogether gay-friendly world of professional wrestling. I guess that'd make me an Aunt Tom, sure enough. Other cynics called me a glory grabber whose only concern was cheap publicity, and while it's true that I managed the puffery as closely as I could, my motives were simply this. As someone who grew up loving professional wrestling and hating being gay, I hoped to connect with ambivalent gay youth. And that's all I wanted. And since becoming champion, I have. Okay, so I had one teensy-weensy ulterior motive, my own personal gay agenda, one might say, but we'll explore that later. As for my critics, they reasoned that many wrestling fans don't knowingly know any GLBT folk at all. And my hitting the fans over their collective head with any image was more stereotyped than archetype, that was anything short of a tie-sporting, Volvo-driving, young gay professional with a life partner, white picket fence, a dog, a cat, and 2.2 adopted Somali babies would do irreparable harm to our collective image. After I came out, a lot of publicity people swirled around me like publicity people swirling around an out gay professional wrestler. And I hit them with a consistent message. It's okay to boo me for what I do, but it's not okay to boo me because of who I am. And surprising me not at all, the fans got it. They understood that when engaged in what they called cheating, I prefer the term boldly reinterpreting the rules, they made their displeasure known. But when I engaged in my rather elaborate red, bright, and shiny ring entrances, they ka-cheered. The media is another element that hasn't quite known how to handle me, so to speak. More than once, I encountered some chronicler of popular culture who was absolutely crestfallen that I hadn't been hauled kicking and screeching into the shower room and beaten within an inch of my rainbow-stained life by unreasoning homophobes. One photographer in particular was adamant. "What's the story?" he wailed to the heavens, overtly souring that his feather boa ensnared bruiser of a subject had been, you know, accepted by his colleagues. "What's the story? What's the story?" "Crikes, I don't know. I wrestle and I blow guys. That's the story." I realized that despite the promises we've made to each other on that magical August sunset, in front of Sasquatch and everyone, Ramon will one day leave me for another. An armada of grunting and groaning suitors serenade Ramon on a regular basis. But I won't lament when Ramon is wrapped around the salty Bella Chubb of another wrestler, because Ramon has helped me realize my personal gay agenda. Helping gay youth has been nice, true, but my main goal in becoming champion is to be able to write for Lavender magazine. No, really, I mean, would I lie to you?
That's my Facebook friend, Terrence Greep. Terrence, thanks very much for letting me catch up with you and learn a little more about you. He does have a website at thespiderbaby.com if you want to learn a little bit more about the bad guy, gay professional wrestler that is Tommy the Spider Baby Saturday. In the Loop is produced, and I mean this in a very serious way, because you did not hear his voice on today's episode, but my goodness, his fingerprints are all over this stuff, by Sandin Totten and me. Much of our bed music is by The Smarts, online at thesmartsband.com. We got kind of a busy schedule coming up around the Twin Cities with gigs here and there, so take a look. We're online at loopfacebook.net and intheloopshow.net. I think in the next few days we're going to be rolling out a new look for our website, and I'm very excited about that, so be sure to check it out. Oh, ow! Well, the studio is falling apart and collapsing on my shins. So, I'm going to call it a day. Everybody, be well, and keep listening to the podcast. Keep in touch with us. Talk to you again soon.